Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. This week, we're going to be discussing retrograde motion and fossil finds. Though, first, I got a little bit of news to discuss. There are two creationist intelligent design evolution events that I'm going to be going to during the week and a little bit of next week. So I'd like to talk about those a little bit. And also, first, before getting into anything, I'd like to mention that the number of subscribers on my feed has gone up by about 104 days. It had been steady for weeks before that. I don't really know what the sudden jump is, but I guess I'd like to welcome all the new listeners to the show, and I hope you enjoy it. So, in Seattle this Wednesday, the Discovery Institute, which is a major intelligent design group that's located in Northwest Washington, they're going to be debating with Peter Ward, who is a professor of biology, I believe, at the University of Washington. And they're going to be debating at the Seattle Town Hall over evolution and intelligent design and which one is backed by scientific evidence along the lines of that. And they're going to have time for question and answer sessions at the end of the debate. So I will be attending that next Wednesday. If anybody else wants to attend, that'd be very interesting to meet some of my listeners, or if not, meet people there just to go and see what the debate's all about. I will report back to everyone and let them know how the debate went next time. And also, there's a local event by just in my area that's going to be discussing creation and evolution, which I also will be attending. Again, I will let everyone know how that goes. Now, I'd like to give you a little update on how the situation is going with Zachary Moore and I. If you remember, Zachary Moore and I are trying to get a kind of group session to discuss creationist claims presented by Kent Hovind on his website, those questions for evolutionists that I mentioned previous times. So we found a way to record stuff, but we just have to set up a time now to record. Hopefully, with any luck, we'll be able to do this next week. I keep saying that every week, but hopefully this time is the final next week, so we'll be able to discuss those questions for evolutionists presented by Kent Hovind. Now, the creationist claim for this week is not going to be, of course, the questions for evolutionists. Instead, it's going to cover one that we've kind of touched on in a very early podcast, but I'd like to go over it again because it helps to clear up a common misconception regarding the Big Bang. Many people think it is an explosion when it is actually an expansion, and there's a big difference. An explosion is, well, you think of Hiroshima or Nagasaki or just a bomb going off, and material will be flying in all directions, but the Big Bang isn't like that. The expansion of the Big Bang is just space itself pulling apart. It's spreading out and bringing the matter with it. The matter doesn't move out at all. In fact, it's not even moving. It's the space that's carrying it along with it. So it'd be like taking a balloon and you draw some dots on the balloon and then you blow the balloon up. The dots that you drew on them aren't moving themselves, but they are moving because space is carrying them. So that's the difference between the Big Bang being an explosion, which is not true, and the Big Bang being an expansion, which is what we currently believe. Now, the claim has to do with the retrograde motion of the planets. Now, retrograde motion of the planets is simply saying that the planets, there are certain planets that spin in a direction opposite to that of what Earth spins, and we call that retrograde motion. These planets are Venus, Uranus, and Pluto. And if we start out with the faulty premise that the Big Bang was an explosion, which is what Kent Hovind does on his website, he says that angular momentum must be conserved, and therefore, if the Big Bang was an explosion, we should expect everything to be spinning in the same direction. Because if the Big Bang blew up, and it was, he starts out also with the premise that it was kind of circling, which doesn't make sense, and we'll get to that in a minute. He says if you start out with a circling Big Bang and it exploded, everything that flew off of it should be spinning in the same direction. Kind of like he gave the example if you were on one of those playground sets where you had the merry-go-round that just went around and around and around, there are a bunch of kids on it, and if they all flew off, they wouldn't go flying off all to the left or all to the right. They'd all accelerate to the, basically away from the center of the object, which is what you'd expect on the merry-go-round. But the Big Bang is a lot different than the merry-go-round. First of all, we did go over that the Big Bang is not an explosion, it was an expansion. And so the whole claim is kind of destroyed right there. Second, his idea that the universe is spinning is incorrect. Our universe is not spinning as far as we can tell. I mean, what would it be spinning in relation to? There's nothing outside of the universe, because that would be included with the universe. any kind of arbitrary lining you make, say this is the universe and this is outside space, you can't do that. The universe is all that there is, according to what we know. And so the universe isn't spinning in relation to anything, because it'd have to be spinning relative to something outside the universe, and there is no such thing. So the premise of a spinning universe is also faulty. So right away, the claim that the retrograde motion of the planets disproves the Big Bang theory is just preposterous, and it's shot down right there. But there are also other things we can add to the case that demonstrate that even if the Big Bang did happen to be an explosion, it wouldn't be correct anyway. And we can do that by showing that our models of the universe do not predict a spread, an even spread of the amount of matter in the universe. That is, there are sections of the universe that have large portions of matter clumped together, and there are also large voids, large empty patches of space. And these voids are going to be subject to the forces of gravity and other forces that are going to affect matter and manipulate it in different ways, so that it's not going to say every single object is going to be rotating in every single way, because gravity is not going to affect everything the same. With we have higher clumps of matter than we have the voids, which are basically devoid of matter. There's very little there. So gravity is going to treat these portions differently, and we're not going to see the same kind of effects and same kind of spin with everything in the universe. So even if we did have an explosion for the Big Bang, which we don't, the claim by Kent Hovind that retrograde motion of the planets would disprove the Big Bang theory is incorrect, because forces and other things in the universe are going to act differently on the planets. Besides, we do have reasons to believe that the planets in our solar system have retrograde motion for a reason. So Venus, Uranus, and Pluto, which are the ones that we mentioned before that do have the retrograde motion, they have retrograde motion most likely due to the large impacts by, say, comets or other types of large space debris that come and peg the planets, basically. These would cause the planets to undergo an orbital change, so a rotation change, excuse me, so that they would be rotating the opposite way of Earth. Now, Venus and Uranus most likely have had this occur to them. We've seen large impacts occur. Just recently, in 1994, the comet Shoemaker-Levy crashed into Jupiter, actually. Fragmented and crashed into Jupiter. Now, Jupiter is so large, it's not going to throw the orbit of Jupiter off, not that particular comet. But it still created sizable impacts and showed us that these kind of impacts still are quite frequent in terms of the history of the solar system. And so that's what we expect for Venus and Uranus. That's why we expect them to have retrograde motion. Now, Pluto's status as a planet is still kind of debated with all the recent Kuiper object belt. I don't know if I said that word right. But this object belt is a region of space from about the orbit of Neptune out to about 6 billion miles from the Sun. And there are a whole bunch of objects that kind of orbit the Sun, but we don't really consider planets. But we're discovering a lot of them that happen to be close to the same size, or one of them we've recently discovered was even larger than Pluto. And it has a satellite, just like Pluto does. So we are kind of debating whether Pluto is actually a planet, so the fact that it has retrograde motion might not need to be explained by the fact that there was might have been a large impact that would have sent it flying off in a different direction. Pluto might actually just be a captured object by the Sun that was spinning in some random way, and we just happened to capture it in a way that spin is opposite than that of Earth. And so this might explain the reason that Pluto has retrograde motion. So overall, the claim that retrograde motion of the planets disproves the Big Bang theory is wrong for all of the reasons we mentioned above. Big Bang's not an explosion, it was not spinning in the beginning, and there are ways to explain the retrograde motion of the planets with large impacts which most likely occurred, and the fact that Pluto is most likely not even really a planet as far as we see it, or if we include it as a planet, we also have to include a lot of the objects we find way out in deep space that are orbiting the Sun at, you know, in the Kuiper object, in the Kuiper belt, like the new planet we just discovered. If you consider Pluto a planet, we kind of must consider the other one a planet. And so this explains away the creationist claim that retrograde motion disproves the Big Bang theory. Moving on to our science topic for this week, I know I kind of mentioned that I was going to be discussing a little more on inflation. However, I haven't finished writing my paper on inflation, so I don't really have all the details on the new chaotic inflation that's we predict now versus the old inflation. And so I felt that before trying to describe it without having all the details, I just wait another week until I have everything finished, and then I would be able to discuss it. So next week we will most likely discuss inflation theory. This week, however, we're going to be discussing the recent fossil finds, as there's been a whole slew of them that have helped fill in gaps in the fossil record that we have not been able to fill in, or we've had to make up hypothetical situations for, but now we have the solid fossil evidence in order to describe certain gaps that we've had in the fossil record. Funny thing about the creationists I talked to who mentioned there are gaps in the fossil record, there's no real way for me to tell them that we've filled in gaps in the fossil record because there are always more to them. If anyone here has heard of Zeno's paradox, it's basically if you have a man walking to a wall, the paradox is he can never get to the wall because you have to go halfway and halfway of that distance and halfway of that distance. And as you go half and half and half, you're never going to hit a point where you can get to the wall. It's always going to be halfway there. And this is sort of what creationists do when you say, for example, you have fossil number 2 and fossil number 3, they want fossil number 2.5. But when you find that one, they say they want fossil 2 and an eighth or something, then 2 3/8, or 2 3/4. So you can never actually fill in the fossil record for them, because when you find a fossil that fills in one gap, you create two more, and just more and more and more, so there's no way to fill it in. And this is the problem with a lot of creationists I run into. They don't make it possible for them to accept the evidence of the fossil record. They always say there are gaps, and of course, by their logic, they will never be filled, because it's mathematically impossible. However, we will be discussing two prominent fossils that we have found. One I'm sure most of you have heard of. It's semi-recent in terms of fossil finds, but the news came out weeks ago. I just neglected to mention it. It was Tiktaalik. And the other fossil was very recent. We discovered it, or at least they mentioned it in the news, about 2 days ago. It's the fossil of it's a snake with hips and back legs. So we'll be discussing those two. First, we'll start out with Tiktaalik. Tiktaalik was not that recent of a fossil find, as I mentioned, but it is a very important transition between the water-dwelling creatures in the early eras of geologic time and the land-based life forms that we are today. Tiktaalik is our intermediary species, our transitional fossil. It appeared to live in the shallows of certain watery areas, but it could also travel across land, which is very important into the evolution of land-based creatures, or tetrapods, which are just four-legged bodied creatures. I went to the University of Chicago's website because they have a whole website devoted to Tiktaalik. It's very useful, and this is basically where I got almost all of my information. Tiktaalik was discovered in Nunavut, Canada on Ellesmere Island. Nunavut is a pretty far north region of Canada, which is basically composed of scattered islands. And because Ellesmere Island is within the Arctic Circle, it has that kind of bizarre phenomena where they have the sun that stays up for 24 hours straight at a certain time in the year, and also the sun will stay down for 24 hours in a different part of the year. I believe this is at winter, and the sun staying up for 24 hours is in the summer, which is a very short region, a few weeks long, which we'll get into a little later, which helps to explain why we don't have that many fossils of Tiktaalik, but that we know there are more out on Ellesmere Island. Now, since there's very little vegetation in this region, Ellesmere Island is pretty great for fossil hunting, since nothing really disturbs the rocks or covers them up. They're just kind of sitting there waiting to be discovered and see the fossils that are in them. Now, the period during which these fossils can be acquired is very short in the Arctic Circle, as we mentioned before. The summer is only about a month long. So the whole rocks containing the fossils have to be basically picked up, helicoptered out, and brought to labs in the United States or other regions, where the fossils will be removed from the rock and we can discover more about them. Now, if you're wondering where the name Tiktaalik came from, it received its name from the Nunavut people. The scientists who were working with this fossil dig, they asked a council of the Nunavut people to ask them basically what to call their find, and they wanted to call it Tiktaalik. This is Inuktitut, which is the language of the region, for shallow water fish, which perfectly described what Tiktaalik is, a fish that's kind of a transitional between the water, totally water-based creatures and the land-dwelling creatures. Now, Tiktaalik is a fossil from the Devonian era. This is a period of geologic time that lasted about 60 million years, and it started about 415 million years ago, so it's fairly old. Now, Tiktaalik is a very, very important find. It's about as good of a transitional fossil as Archaeopteryx, which is our very interesting transitional fossil between dinosaurs and birds. It shares many features with fish, that is, Tiktaalik does, not Archaeopteryx, but it also has a lot of indicators that it's partly a tetrapod, which basically means four-legged animal. Tiktaalik has, for instance, gills, so it can breathe underwater. And these are very, I guess I could say, lesser developed gills, that is, they would basically become ears, which they do in later human beings. Excuse me, not later human beings, but later tetrapods. But it also possesses lungs, which is basically needed for land-breathing creatures, so Tiktaalik would also cross land, that's why it had those lungs. So Tiktaalik is kind of a half-and-half between a water-dwelling and a land-dwelling creature. It has a little bit of both. And while Tiktaalik has scales like a fish, it also had a free-moving neck, which no fish has. It's basically just the body attached to the head, but in Tiktaalik, it's got a freely moving neck. This is a common feature among land animals, but as stated before, it does not exist on any fish. All the pictures I've seen of Tiktaalik sort of remind me of a crocodile, and the skeletal structure that it has reflects this. Tiktaalik has large ribs to help it support the weight of gravity as it crawled on the land. It was anywhere between 4 to 9 feet in length, which I was surprised. I thought it was just going to be a little fish, but it's fairly long. It also has eyes that rest on the top of its head, kind of like a crocodile, so they don't rest to the side. Now, we have not found any rear fins or tails, but I'm guessing we're going to find these on later expeditions. Scientists haven't been able to acquire all the fossils out on the Ellesmere Island. The window of time that they can actually dig for these fossils, as I said before, was just so short. They've only been able to pick up a few at a time. They got to be very careful when removing these fossils and the rocks themselves. So the storms that kind of come in as soon as summer ends hinder the progress that they can make, and they just cover the landscape for most of the year. So this is Tiktaalik, and it's important, as I stated before, because it is a transitional fossil between water-dwelling and land-dwelling creatures. And the amount of transitional features it has make it a very important fossil find and good evidence for the evolution of creatures from water-dwelling regions to land-dwelling regions. And this is why Tiktaalik is important. Next, we have a snake with hind legs and hip, which is very bizarre, and it changed our whole notion of what evolution of these snakes would be. This snake is called Najash rionigria. I can't really pronounce it. Let me say it one more time. Najash rionigrina. And this name comes from the biblical Hebrew name for biblical legged snake, and that was the name that the discoverers wanted to give it. So that's where they got its name. We didn't know before if snakes had evolved on land or in water, but this fossil seems to put the nail in the coffin for the group who thought they were originally sea monsters, as Oliver Repill, an expert on the evolution of snakes, had once thought. So he was the one who had kind of advocated this snakes evolving in the water view, and that they'd kind of come on land, but it seems to be quite the opposite of what he thought. And so this snake fossil kind of filled in our gaps regarding snake evolution. The fossil itself is about 92 million years old and has fully preserved hips and back legs. And from what the scientists can tell, these legs that they have, they weren't used for walking, because it wouldn't really help the creature just to have back legs kind of pushing it around. It wouldn't get very far. Instead, what they think is these back legs and the hips were used to brace the snake itself, or the proto-snake, I should say, before it's going to lunge at prey. So it would kind of get itself ready and lunge at the creature before taking it out and eating it. So that's what the legs were most likely for. So these are the most recent fossil finds we've had. They're very important, as I stated before. They filled in our knowledge gaps regarding snake evolution and the evolution of land-based creatures from water-dwelling ones. And so hopefully we're filling in more of a fossil record, and we'll be able to find more of these transitional fossils. At the rate we've been going in these past months, we're going to be able to find, I think, a lot more fossils to fill in the gaps in the record. So this is the whole show for this week. I know it's sort of short, but I didn't have much to do, so I guess I should give him my email again. I always forget to do that. Email is rlippens, that's LIPPENS, at wavecable.com. So if anybody wants to email me questions, comments, concerns, go right ahead. I guess all I have to say is next week we will most likely discuss inflation theory. So until then, we will talk next week.